The following is a Reels Channel and Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
An extravagant Beverly Hills businessman is mercilessly executed in his home. Brought to a remote canyon and disfigured with a shotgun. Soon after, a wealthy Iranian exile is brutally suffocated in a trunk. Police have little to go on until terrified informants tell them of a young commodities broker who brags of committing the perfect crime.
Cannot claim that there is a line you won't cross.
He would do anything to make things right for himself, including murder.
The investigation discovers damning evidence written on a legal pad and exposes a covert organization of young blue bloods where the only rule is greed.
You never seen a check for $1.5 million before?
And the only sin is not being rich enough.
There are no shortcuts to success.
I'm going
to
get that money.
He's not just going to give it to you, Joe.
Then I'm going to kill him.
Johan has no regard for life whatsoever.
He wanted to be a big shot.
It does come down to trust, doesn't it?
Meet Joe Hunt.
Joe Hunt.
Mastermind of the deadly organization known as the Billionaire Boys Club.
The Billionaire Boys Club.
Until murder made him famous. The unearthing of the so-called Billionaire Boys Club and its lurid crimes both fascinated and repulsed the American public and the media in the mid-1980s.
The 1980s were an amazing time in America. We now had a new generation that was interested in one thing, money.
A cautionary tale of a decade's excess, the story spawned a highly rated miniseries starring original Brat Pack member Judd Nelson.
Now, our corporation, the BBC, is looking for guys like you who, frankly, want to start at the top.
The miniseries inspired Beverly Hills brothers Lyle and Eric Menendez to murder their parents for money a few years later. What makes the story so incredible is that most members of the Billionaire Boys Club were from wealthy families and didn't have to worry about their financial futures. But the charisma of the organization's unlikely leader, Joe Hunt, was too powerful to ignore. The result was at least two dead, numerous lives ruined, and a legacy of inexplicable tragedy. Future killer Joe Hunt is born Joseph Gamsky and grows up in a lower middle class home in Granada Hills, California.
His father changed the name early on, and Joe, for whatever reason, became kind of a wheeler dealer, even in school. He wanted to be a big shot.
Extremely bright, Joe earns a scholarship to the prestigious Harvard School for Boys, with such notable alumni as Richard Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, former California Governor Gray Davis, and current Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti.
Former detective Les Zollner.
He was kind of a geeky young kid, and he got into these groups by being the smart kid.
Defense attorney Arthur Behrens.
He had a literally photographic memory. His recall was impressive.
Joe graduates from the Harvard School, and in early 1983, he forms his own investment club, which he names the BBC, after his favorite restaurant, the Bombay Bicycle Club.
Senior crime reporter Steve Helling.
So when Joe started recruiting for the Billionaire Boys Club, he had some names in his address book that would work. Former classmates from prep school who came from rich families, they had money, they had some deep pockets.
Among his first two recruits are former classmates from Harvard prep school, Ben Dosti and Dean Carney, who Joe names as second in command.
Once he was able to get a couple of them, then more would fall in line.
Two crucial members were critical to giving the BBC legitimacy. Twin brothers Tom and Dave May, heirs to the May department store fortune.
Dave and Tom May, who came from money, would really be able to fund this club in the way that they wanted them to fund it. So they pulled out all the stops to bring them in.
I don't know, man. Dad really wants Dave and I to go with a more established firm.
So what, you can start at the bottom? Right. Listen, Tom, here, you start at the top.
and you stay at the top. I mean, you already have an advantage. You come from a wealthy family.
And you've got built-in investors.
So you bring clients to the BBC. I invest the money in commodities, and you get an absurd share of the profits. I mean, everybody wins.
But commodities are risky, right?
Not Joe's system. It's virtually risk-free.
And how do we know that?
It does come down to trust, doesn't it? See, but you guys already know me. We went to school together. The real question is, do you trust me enough to make you an absurd, ridiculous amount of money?
This is a different world, and they wanted to have that world without having to work for it.
The May twins join the Billionaire Boys Club and begin pumping hundreds of thousands of dollars into the organization.
Joe really had the it factor. He was persuasive. He was attractive. He had this magnetism that people really wanted to be part of whatever he was part of.
Look, from now on, gentlemen, anytime that you're... You can go. Thank you. Anytime that you are seen in public, the best Armani suits, the best restaurants, okay? No more driving around in that car that Daddy bought you for college, all right?
You want to play with the big boys, you got to look like a winner.
A toast. Gentlemen, to the Billionaire Boys Club.
By that fall, with money pouring into the BBC, they lease office space at the Wells Fargo building in Beverly Hills and rent two apartments in the newly built Wilshire Manning condominium. There, Joe hires the doorman, Jim Pittman, to be his director of security.
He was at Hunt's beck and call and was a confidant of Hunt's.
The recruits are young and easily influenced by the charisma and ambition of Joe Hunt. But the organization becomes more of a social club than an investment group.
Associate press reporter Linda Deutsch.
They got sidetracked by this idea that they could make a quick buck, more than a quick buck, big bucks. They were interested in what money could buy, in luxury. They wanted the Armani suits. They wanted the fancy cars, particularly in Beverly Hills.
Joe had over $1 million in the bank that he was supposed to be investing for these guys. The only problem was he wasn't investing well.
In the market, Joe is losing big. He is paying investors with other investors' money, beginning a Ponzi scheme that has no chance of succeeding.
Joe was spending so much money to keep up the appearances of wealth and success that he was really bleeding money at this point.
They had all these things that they thought would be excellent ways to make money. But, of course, nothing really made any money. They had problems with almost everything they did.
So Joe realizes that he's robbing Peter to pay Paul and that at some point this money is going to dry up unless he can find another big fish. And then he meets Ron Levin.
In 1983, they meet 40-year-old Ron Levin, who boasts about his wealth as a Beverly Hills businessman.
How about another round of drinks for my friends? Hey. That's what I thought. Have some more. It's...
Whoa, Ron, what is that?
This?
Yeah.
This is a deposit for my Swiss account.
Damn!
What? You never seen a check for $1.5 million before?
Well, now we have.
And you may never again.
I want you to get me a meeting with this guy, Ron Levin. He can't stop blabbing about his money.
Joe is intrigued by Levin's propensity to flaunt his wealth. It takes some time, but Joe eventually gains Levin's trust.
What you're entitled to? Cry me a friggin' river, Osborne. These are life lessons. Next time, don't be such a chump.
Ron Levin.
Mr. Levin, Joe Hunt. We met in Westwood last summer.
The premiere party. So that's how you found me, huh?
Have a seat.
So, I've been looking into the BBC. You guys have pulled together some impressive clientele for having no track record.
Thank you.
Truth. Are you even licensed to trade? Pass your Series 3? Relax. I don't judge morality. I'm a damn thief myself. So what can I do for you, Joe Hunt?
I want to make you money.
I got enough money.
You and I both know that you can never have enough money. That's why I want to show you what I can do with commodities.
Commodities? Did you hear the one about the commodities trader who made $1 million? He started off with two. Beverly, two cappuccinos.
He was on the ropes, and he needed a big score fast.
A phone call from Ron Levin will change the course of Joe Hunt's life and everyone involved in the BBC, but with shocking consequences. Beverly Hills, 1983. Joe Hunt and his band of investors, known as the Billionaire Boys Club, believe they are on their way to global fame and fortune. But in reality, Joe is the architect of a collapsing Ponzi scheme. In an attempt to secure more funds, he pursues big shot investor Ron Levin.
So, Joe Hunt?
Joe, Ron Levin.
Yes, sir.
I've been thinking about our little talks. Truth is, Joe, I see myself in you. I want to give you a shot for no other reason than you're hungry.
Oh, yes, sir, I am.
Joe was supposedly a great investor in the commodities market, so Ron Levin said, well, I can use that.
So I'm going to set you up with a trading account at Clayton Brokerage. A $5 million line. Whatever you make, you keep half.
You know what? You have made the right decision, Mr. Levin.
No, I didn't. This is charity. And Joe?
Yes?
Don't lose my money.
For Joe, this is music to his ears. The money problems will be all gone with a check for $5 million.
Joe Hunt spends the next 7 weeks making trades in the commodities market. Success means a desperately needed commission check for the BBC.
Now, I know we've had losses in certain areas. What many of you don't know is that 7 weeks ago, Mr. Levin set me up with a trading account with a $5 million line. Well, I am excited to tell you that I've made $9 million for Mr. Levin.
That is a $4.5 million commission for the BBC.
Hunt took the $5 million and made $13 million out of it.
What do you all say we go out and treat ourselves? Yeah. All right.
But the BBC would not see a single penny of Ron Levin's money.
Yeah, Ron Levin, please.
Who's calling?
This is Joe Hunt.
He's not in. Would you like to leave a message?
No. Look, I already left him several messages. Listen. It is very important that I speak with him.
I'm sorry, he's not here.
Well, when... Okay. All right, yep.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I got it. I understand.
Joe didn't have access to this $13 million, but he thought it was there. But there was always an excuse. There was always a reason why Ron couldn't write the check. It was either his accountant's fault or something else was going on. So Joe was getting more and more impatient and more upset because he wanted the money that he believed that he had earned.
Joe finally decides to take matters into his own hands and contacts the brokerage company directly.
Hello?
Hey, Jack, it's Joe Hunt.
Oh, hey, Joe, how's it going?
It's going. Look, I'm looking for Ron Levin, but I'm having a hell of a time reaching him. Do you know where he is?
Ron? No, haven't seen him for weeks.
Okay, all right, well, thanks.
Hey, whatever happened with that experiment you guys were doing with the trading?
Experiment?
You know, the documentary Ron was making?
Yeah, we finished it.
That was pretty interesting, setting up a fake account with no money in it.
It was a real twist ending.
Ultimately, he found out that there was no money, that none of the trades had been executed, and the fortune he thought he made was non-existent.
What Ron had done was convinced a brokerage firm that he was making a documentary about making money.
And he says, I want it to look real, so I don't want you to say that this is sample. So they begrudgingly said, okay.
And so there was this fake account with fake money in it that They weren't to act on any of Joe's investment decisions.
Ron Levin then takes the fake account statements worth $13 million and secures a large loan from another firm for himself.
Ron knew the money was fake. The brokerage firm knew the money was fake. The only person who didn't know was Joe.
This right here? Fake. Fake. None of my buy or sell orders were ever acted on.
I don't get it. Why would he do that?
He took those fake account statements and pulled out a $1 million line of credit from another firm. It's genius.
So what are we gonna do?
What do you think? I'm gonna get my money from Levin.
He's not just gonna give it to you, Joe.
Then I'm gonna kill him.
Joe Hunt wanted his money, and he was going to stop at nothing to get what he believed was his.
It was so incredibly stupid on the part of Ron Levin that he thought he could get away with this. He clearly underestimated Joe Hunt. He underestimated his cunning, and he underestimated his cruelty.
So Joe begins to plan Ron Levin's death, and he's not going to leave any details up to chance.
Joe Hunt, along with his bodyguard Jim Pittman, a.k.a. Jim Graham, meticulously planned the attack on Ron Levin.
He had this list of, you know, close the blinds and set the alarm and kill the dog and make a file.
It was meticulous, it was methodical, and he was going to do it, and he was going to do it right.
June 6th, 1984, to Ron Levin's surprise, Joe Hunt shows up at his house and brings him dinner.
He knew that Ron Levin always liked company, so he knew that Ron Levin would invite him in.
I'm glad you've come around to my way of thinking, Joe. You have to admit, if you'd known those trades weren't real, you'd have gone about it recklessly. Besides, we're a million up now, and I've invested the BBC share into a shopping mall. Now that's an investment. Real estate. Who the hell is that?
Don't worry about it. Your housekeeper's gone. I'll get it.
And suddenly, there's a knock at the door.
And it was Jim Pittman, which was all planned, of course, by Joe.
What's going on?
Go ahead.
Tell them. Ron, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I owe some people some money, and they're real heavy hitters. I told them you owed me money. I didn't think they'd show up here. I'm really sorry.
Now, who's going to pay me my $3.5 million?
What do you want?
Shut up! Now, I'm walking out of here with my money. Or the both of you are going to die tonight.
What do you want? I can write you a check?
How much?
I have $1.5 million in a Swiss account.
Write the check. Write the check. Come on, let's go!
Okay.
Joe Hunt introduced Jim Pittman to him, and he said, he's a mafia hitman that I owe money to, and they want the money that you owe me.
This isn't just any con that they're doing, because Jim has a gun. It's a loaded gun, and he's threatening to kill Joe, to kill Ron, and even kill Ron's dog.
Shut that damn dog up! I'm gonna shoot him in the face! Shut him up!
Please don't shoot my dog! Please don't shoot my dog! Don't shoot!
Hurry up.
Shoot me,
hurry
please.
Up.
Shoot me. Not my dog. Not my dog.
Ron Levin adored his dog, and Joe Hunt knew that.
And the minute that Ron heard that his dog was in jeopardy, he was willing to do anything.
Please. Okay.
Thank you. Ron.
Oh, my God.
What have you gotten yourself into?
Ron Levin realizes all too late that he himself has been conned.
No!
Get in the bedroom. Get in the bedroom!
Okay. Please, just don't hurt my dog. Oh, please, please don't do this. I get what you want.
Do it. Do it.
We'll be right back.
I've never heard anyone take their last breath before. All right. Got some stuff to do.
They ended up rolling the comforter up and taking the body out the back door, locked the house up, did not set the alarm, and left.
They put Levin's body in the back of Joe's BMW, and they take it out to Soledad Canyon.
They deposit the body of Ron Levin in a grave dug previously by Jim Pittman.
All right, well, let's make sure he's never recognized, huh?
They then disfigure the corpse with a shotgun.
Oh! Did you see that? His brain popped out of his skull and fell on his chest.
Cruel and cold, and then they buried him.
But even in death, Ron Levin has a big surprise for Joe Hunt.
Murder Made Me Famous. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
Here at Podcast One, we love hearing from you. We read every tweet and comment you send our way. So don't miss your chance to take our summer listener survey. Just go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner. Or go to podcastone.com/mysurvey. It only takes a few minutes, and it gives you the opportunity to make a direct impact on your favorite shows. Tell us how you really feel so we can get to know you better. We value your thoughts and participation. So check out the survey at podcastone.com/mysurvey. Or click on the survey banner on podcastone.com.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised. The bizarre events that begin to unfold in June of 1984 would soon shock the nation and spawn a highly rated television miniseries. Billionaire Boys Club frontman Joe Hunt and his bodyguard force Beverly Hills businessman Ron Levin to sign away $1.5 million. Then they execute him and disfigure his corpse with a shotgun. But it seems Ron Levin would get the last laugh.
What's up? Levin's check. What about it? It bounced. What? There's nothing in the account.
As it turns out, Ron Levin wasn't just a boisterous businessman. He was a full-fledged con man, eking out a small living on his often convoluted scams.
You know, he would brag about having a Swiss bank account, and he did have a Swiss bank account. It had $200 in it, but he had one.
Former prosecutor Fred Wapner.
He lived high on the hog like he was a rich guy, and he didn't have a dime to his name. There was testimony in the case from his parents. They had to pay his rent.
He was essentially a con man. He was able to get by with small cons.
With his private investment group broke, Joe Hunt decides it's time to confide in his members.
Joe, you cannot tell people what we did.
Listen, Jim. I am going to tell them. You understand?
Okay.
Okay.
Less than 3 weeks after Ron Levin's murder, Joe holds a meeting with the BBC.
See, I call it the paradox philosophy. It is the code of ethics central to our culture here at the BBC, and it dictates that the ends always justify the means.
Meaning?
Tell me, would you murder someone?
No, of course not.
Okay. What if that someone was, say, raping your mother?
In that specific case, yeah.
So you would kill them?
Yeah.
So you cannot claim that there is a line you won't cross. There are no moral absolutes, are there? It is simply a matter of believing that a situation requires a necessary action. And that, my friends, sometimes means transgressing the law. What I'm about to tell you, gentlemen and ladies, will require you to accept more responsibility than you ever have before. Anyone who doesn't want to hear this information should leave the room now. But if you stay, then you're committed. Jim Pittman and I knocked off Ron Levin. Additionally, there were some major setbacks in the commodities market, and our funds have been wiped out. However, if we stick together, I am confident that we'll get through this.
It's just cockiness, like nobody's ever going to catch me. Nobody will rat on me. I've got complete control over these guys. I can tell them. They won't tell anybody. They'll do anything I say.
Need I remind you that you had the opportunity to leave the room. None of you took it. And now you are bound by that decision. Anyone who talks about this with anyone will be dealt with severely. If you don't believe me, just ask Ron Levin.
Well, they should have been scared of Joe Hunt. Absolutely. I mean, most of these kids were in way over their heads.
It's crazy what he was doing. He was telling people about a crime that he had committed. And this isn't what these guys had signed up for. This was an investment club.
Disturbed and now fearing for their lives, the May brothers turn on Joe Hunt and the BBC and begin working with the police.
They make their decision pretty quickly that they actually need to start building a case against Joe.
Others, however, stay the course with Joe. Dean Carney stays, and he and Joe meet with a new member, a man named Reza Eslamania. His father, Hidayat, is a wealthy Iranian political exile, reportedly worth more than $30 million.
Well, that's a lot of money, Reza.
I know. But the son of a bitch has no intention of willing any of it to me, his son, his own blood. I want what's coming to me.
Do you? Listen, Reza. Have I ever told you about our code of ethics at the BBC? I call it the paradox philosophy.
Reza Eslaminia has an agenda of his own. What he wants to do is take over his father's business. And they come up with a plan. They'll kidnap his father and force him to sign the business over to Reza.
On the night of June 30th, 1984, the group drives to Hidayat's estate in a U-Haul. Wearing fake UPS uniforms, Joe and Ben Dosti get Hidayat to answer the door.
Yes.
Good evening, sir. We have a package for an Hidayat Eslaminia.
What package? I didn't order this.
Hidayat Eslaminia opens the door and is attacked by Joe and Ben.
Come on, Ben.
They wrestle him down, and then they take a rag soaked in chloroform, and they knock him out.
Let's get the trunk.
Yeah.
They put him in a trunk, and not the trunk of a car, but a storage trunk, and take him to a motel.
What follows is the full depth of Joe Hunt's blind and ruthless pursuit of money.
They began going further and further down the rabbit hole. None of them had the sense to say to any of them, "Guys, this may not be a good idea."
When they opened the back of the truck, they notice Hidayat struggling to breathe inside the sealed trunk.
I can't breathe. Help me. Help me. I can't breathe.
He's gasping for air. Gotta make some air holes or something.
There's tools up front.
They create air holes so Hidayat can breathe.
Shut up.
But he begins screaming, so they tape the holes up again.
Okay, it's done. So, I've used almost all of our available cash, but we have the house running for 6 weeks.
Okay, good. Because that'll become the torture chamber for Mr. Ezel. What's his face?
Who's going to do the torturing?
I will, happily.
He stopped making noise.
As they open the trunk, they are greeted with a blast of hot air and the smell of urine. Hadayat is dead.
Now we have to forge a signature.
Most of the other guys were horrified. This isn't what they signed up for. The only person who was unfazed by the whole thing was Joe.
Joe, Dean, and Jim prepare to dump Eslamania in Soledad Canyon, near where they had previously dumped Ron Levin.
Maybe we should check and see if he's still alive. You know?
And then what?
Huh?
Well, you wanna take him back, set him in his living room, say sorry? You wanna pretend like all of this didn't happen? Grab the trunk. All right, ready?
Yeah.
What Joe doesn't realize is that yet another stinging financial surprise awaits him.
We've checked all of his Lamini's accounts. There's nothing there.
Wow. Did you just say nothing?
There was never any $30 million, Joe. The money never made it out of Iran.
It turns out that Reza has exaggerated his father's holdings. Most of the bank accounts don't exist or are low on funds.
And what's worse is our investors are screaming for their money and we are broke.
Screw them.
I have no legal obligation to pay them back.
You can't just tell 70 people that we spent all of their money.
Get yourself together. Get yourself together.
One by one, more Billionaire Boys Club members begin to talk with police. In August, detectives learn of Joe Hunt's meeting with the club in which he said he knocked off Ron Levin.
That's pretty much what started the ball rolling as far as my investigation.
Detective Les Zoller of the Beverly Hills Police Department executes a search of Ron Levin's home. And what he finds will spell the end for Joe Hunt.
Mr. Levin?
Yes.
Detective Zoller?
Come in.
Detective Les Zoller of the Beverly Hills Police Department executes a search at the home of missing person and presumed murder victim, Ron Levin.
After we talked to the May brothers, we said we have some concrete evidence of Ron Levin's death.
Did your son leave any type of financial records anywhere? Maybe a list of names of people he's done business with?
Zoller suspects Billionaire Boys Club president Joe Hunt of being involved in the crime, but as yet has little evidence, until he discovers a handwritten list.
The kill list that Joe had made that meticulously explains what he's going to do. Joe had left it at the victim's house.
I looked at it, and it said, to-do list.
The list is in Joe Hunt's handwriting.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And to be honest with you, I don't think Joe Hunt knew that he had left it.
Joe Hunt's world of money and murder is collapsing around him, and there will be no escaping the consequences of his actions.
Priest! Put your hands in here!
But before he could leave, the cops got him.
Suspected for the murder of Ron Levin, Joe Hunt sits unfazed in an interrogation room at the Beverly Hills Police Department.
His strategy was just going to be to lie and lie and lie and lie and say, no, I'm innocent. I didn't do anything. He didn't think that they had any sort of smoking gun.
He was just giving answers that he had thought of probably months beforehand. And finally, it got to the point where I had a file, and I pulled these copy of these 7 pages of to-do. And I put it in front of him, and I said, what can you tell me about this? And Joe Hunt, who was very cocky through the whole interview, now was silent.
Ironically, Joe Hunt's perfectly planned murder was undone by the fact that he left those plans at the crime scene.
And he was going through each page, reading every word, and then going back through each page, give him as much time as he wanted. And then I said, what can you tell me about that, Joe? Well, I think I should contact my attorney. And the interview was over.
He immediately hires high-power defense attorney Arthur Behrens.
When I first heard the story of what Joe Hunt was accused of, it sounded impossible to me that those facts could have been true. So then I met with Joe Hunt, and like most people, I found him fascinating and intriguing. I increasingly became convinced of the fact that Joe Hunt was innocent.
But even Barrons can't protect Joe from what happens next.
Then everything started falling apart. Everybody started to talk. And then Dean Carney, who was Hunt's sidekick, decided he made a deal with the prosecution to get witness protection after he testified. He was sure he'd be killed.
He literally knew where the bodies were buried. He knew where they had dumped Eslaminia's body off of a cliff.
So within the next day or two, we went out with Dean Carney and recovered the remains of Hideo Eslaminia.
And he was later able to tell them where Joe said he had put Ron Levin's body.
Police search but never find Levin's body. However, Joe, Jim, club member Ben Dosti, and Reza Eslaminia are charged with the murder of Hidayat Eslaminia, Reza's father, allegedly to acquire his $30 million fortune, which never existed.
It was the most high-profile case in Los Angeles County that year, bar none.
National media picks up the story and has a field day.
Rich people, rich kids, two murders, happened in Beverly Hills. TV loves that stuff.
It was a bonanza for the prosecution and also for Hollywood. I mean, you take a title like Billionaire Boys Club, and you've got a movie.
Like any good movie villain, Joe Hunt seems to relish his role.
Joe Hunt would strut around the courthouse like a peacock. He was cocky. He was arrogant.
Occasionally, he had a smirk on his face like, you know, you're not going to get me. I'm Joe Hunt.
Hunt, it was not the most likable individual. Even if I thought a client of mine had done a heinous crime, I could still be friends with him, so to speak. I was never friends with Joe Hunt.
As unpersonable as Joe was, the prosecution still had to convince a jury that Ron Levin was dead, and not just conning everyone.
The fact that he was never found became something that hovered over the courtroom during that trial. The defense attorney had a habit of looking toward the back of the courtroom and saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Levin might just walk in there right now." And we would all turn around and look.
This was trying to get them to turn their heads to demonstrate to one another that they did have doubt. Not proven, not guilty.
Ron Levin was being cited everywhere after he disappeared. He was in Beverly Hills. He was in Washington State. He was in New York. He was even in Mykonos, Greece. I don't know what it was, but, you know, nobody was more recognized except Elvis.
We did, at least from my view, have the argument to say, look, Ron Levin is not the kind of guy who could disappear, as the defense alleges, because he needed to be in the limelight. He needed to be conning people. Putting aside the fact that he didn't have any money to support himself, he just couldn't disappear.
It isn't long before other members start turning against Joe.
Jim Pittman would eventually confess that he had killed Ron, but none of it was ever proven because the body was never found. It was very weird.
Helping the prosecution is Joe Hunt's to-do list, a damning piece of evidence and one that mystifies the public. Why would someone so shrewd and meticulous overlook something so incriminating?
I don't mind saying that I slept with the 7-page letter next to my bed for almost 2 years. Very compelling piece of evidence. It spoke volumes. What Pittman had to say eventually played right into what the letter said.
Billionaire Boys Club members testify about the June 24th meeting.
Joe started off by stating that he and Jim Graham had knocked off or bumped off or taken care of Ron Levin.
And Joe turned to me and he said, look, Tom, you're going to find out sooner or later I killed Ron Levin.
But perhaps the most devastating of all is the testimony of Dean Carney, who, as Joe's closest friend, tells all.
He was Joe Hunt's right-hand man, and he was the chief witness in the case, and he was terrified.
He knew that Joe was a cold-blooded murderer who always got his way and would stop at nothing to make sure that he himself was protected.
And he did testify to everything, including the killing of Ron Levin. And after it was all over, I think he just disappeared.
Dean ultimately went into the Federal Witness Protection Program, and as far as I know, is still in the Federal Witness Protection Program.
Noticeably absent from the stand is Joe Hunt himself.
I labored over that decision from minute one about Joe not testifying. I felt that I had enough trouble with the 7-page letter. The letter spoke more loudly than anything Joe Hunt could have said.
But Joe Hunt will speak.
I am an innocent man.
In a confident attempt to avoid the death penalty. On April 22, 1987, at the age of 26, billionaire Boys Club leader Joe Hunt is found guilty of the first-degree murder of Ron Levin.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Joe Hunt, guilty of murder in violation of...
It was a credit to the prosecutor that he managed to get a conviction, because no-body cases are very difficult to prosecute. Juries often think, oh, well, maybe he's still alive.
His accomplices face their own trials. Ben Dosti and Ressa Eslemania are both convicted for the death of Hidayat Eslemania. And Jim Pittman pleads guilty to a reduced charge for the death of Ron Levin. The jury finds special circumstances, which in California makes Joe Hunt eligible for the death penalty. Joe shows no emotion. He makes a statement saying Ron Levin is alive and would one day be found, but he is spared the death penalty.
Why do I think the jury gave him life imprisonment? I think the jury really disliked Mr. Hunt. I think they disliked him severely. And I think they gave him life imprisonment so that he'd have to live with himself the rest of his life and think about what he had done and how he put himself in that position.
Joe Hunt still faces charges for the death of Eslemania. And this time, he decides to defend himself.
Everybody says you don't represent yourself in a court of law. You need an advocate for you.
Joe Hunt, representing himself in court in the Eslemania case, was astounding.
There is one voice that will never be stifled, and that's the voice of an innocent man talking about his innocence. And I am an innocent man.
Amazingly, Joe Hunt manages to get a hung jury.
He was probably the first defendant ever to represent himself and escape the death penalty.
There's a difference between being a good lawyer and a good defendant. Remember, as a good lawyer, you're not being cross-examined. You are doing the cross-examination. And as Eslemania, they did not have the 7-page letter.
He had educated himself in prison as a lawyer, and he was good at it.
Due to a hung jury, Joe escapes the death penalty for the murder of Hidayat Eslemania. He is never retried for this crime. It appears the prosecution is content to let Joe Hunt remain in prison for the rest of his life for the murder of Ron Levin. Ron Levin's body has never been found. Did the great con man con everyone?
I'll tell you, if Ron Levin showed up tomorrow, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he was such a con artist that he could be lurking, waiting, but it doesn't seem like it. It seems like he probably was killed.
The legacy of Joe Hunt and the Billionaire Boys Club came to television in 1987 when legendary Brat Packer Judd Nelson portrayed Hunt in a standout performance that earned him a Golden Globe nomination.
No body, no witnesses, full documentation. Even if only a couple of us stick to the story, we will still create reasonable doubt in any jury.
What a waste. What a waste of talent. I feel sorry for him. That just what a loss it was that his life didn't turn out better, particularly with the potential he had.
As a final fatal legacy, brothers Lyle and Eric Menendez watched a re-airing of the miniseries The Billionaire Boys Club in 1989. Excited and inspired by it, they murdered their wealthy parents with shotguns. They, too, would face justice.
There are no shortcuts to success. Hard work is what America has been built on, and I'm a true believer in that. That is the way you get achievement in this world. You're not going to get lucky. No one is going to hand it to you on a silver platter. You have to apply yourself to be successful. These young men, I think, were looking for a shortcut to success.
The fantasy became violence, and that was never, I don't think that was ever in the cards. They never planned for it to be violent. It's not like these guys set out to be murderers. They didn't. But because of everything that happened, they were sucked into a vortex at which the center was the ultimate crime, which is kill your enemy. And they perceived Ron Levin as their enemy.
That concludes this episode of Murder Made Me Famous. Don't forget to go to Reels.com, that's R-E-E-L-Z.com, for clips, extras, and more. And check out new episodes every Saturday on the Reels channel. Don't forget to subscribe on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.